This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome. The Affordable Care Act is a sprawling piece of legislation with many moving parts. And as Republicans in Congress try to wrap their arms around the enormity of their promise to repeal it, those insured under the ACA are trying to wrap their heads around the possibility of a future without health insurance. This hour, we're going to take a close look at the process and how it might play out. Do Republicans repeal and replace, or repeal and delay? And to complicate matters further, President-elect Trump spoke to the Washington Post over the weekend, telling reporters he is putting the finishing touches on a replacement plan, one with the objective of insurance for everybody, a goal which might well receive some pushback from the right. As always, we'd like to know what you think. What's your opinion of the Affordable Care Act? And does the ACA affect you directly? The number is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And joining us now to get the conversation started is Dan Diamond, author of Politico Pulse, a morning briefing on healthcare politics and policy. Hi, Dan.
Mary, good morning. And I went to school in Philly and was an avid WHYY fan. This is better than a tote bag, I'm sharing with you now.
Why? Thank you so much. We appreciate that. All right. So let's tackle Mr. Trump's conversation over the weekend with the Post and how his proposal to repeal the ACA might play with his intent to provide, in his words, insurance for everybody. And Dan, to be clear, you know, Sean Spicer, the incoming press secretary, has clarified that we're not talking about government sanctioned universal health care here. So what do you think we're talking about?
Well, it's funny, within 12 hours or 18 hours, Trump's advisors very quickly walked back his statement that he was working on insurance for everybody. I saw someone make a funny joke that Trump isn't going to provide universal health care. He's just letting his aides do the universal application of Republican talking points on health care, because Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway came out and laid out a plan that actually sounded very much like the kinds of plans that Rand Paul, Paul Ryan, and others have talked about to replace the Affordable Care Act. So there's kind of two tracks going on right now. Congress is working on an actual replacement plan, and Donald Trump is coming out with something that's more about the optics and trying to reassure people that their coverage isn't immediately going to go away.
Okay. Well, apparently part of the Trump proposal would be to force drug companies to negotiate directly with the government over prices regarding Medicare and Medicaid. And his quote is, they're politically protected, but not anymore. And first of all, how do you parse this? And isn't this something the Democrats have pushed for?
Great question. We saw this during the campaign, that Trump was adopting this very strong language that Bernie Sanders was similarly putting forward. It's much more a Democratic talking point, that drug companies have too much market power. They need to be reined in. And right now, the government can't negotiate around drug prices for Medicare and Medicaid. That's one reason why they are so expensive. Those costs get passed along. This does seem like something that Trump wants to deliver on, and it might be a way to lure some Democrats over to support a Republican replacement bill. There was a vote last week. It was non-binding, but it got a lot of attention. The Republicans and Democrats in the Senate voted in the middle of the night on how they would essentially lay out the instructions for repealing the Affordable Care Act. And one of the amendments that was put forward was from Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar about giving more power to import drugs from Canada and some other pharmaceutical measures. That got some Republican support and lost some Democratic support, too, including some senators in your region, in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Yeah. But there is possibility for some bipartisan compromise, and maybe that's a way to get some Democrats on board with legislation. I should say it's very early, and no Democrat right now is signaling that they want to do this, but it's floating out there as a possibility.
Well, Dan, let's take a look at the mechanics. So to repeal major chunks, I should say, of the Affordable Care Act, your Republicans simply need a simple majority in both houses, correct? That's for repeal.
For reconciliation in the Senate, they can take apart most of the law. They can't take apart all of it, but it effectively kills the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. But I think when it comes to replacing it, my understanding is to replace certain aspects of the law, they are going to need the help of Democrats, especially in the Senate, where the GOP majority is slim. And, you know, could this be where Republicans run into some trouble?
That's exactly right. So, Mary, I think you said in your intro there's debate about repeal and delay. Do they repeal the law now and take some time to come up with a replacement? that is effectively dead. There are too many Senate Republicans worried about the impact on people who need coverage right now. So they're going for this simultaneous repeal and replace strategy. For that, they do need Democratic votes. They need eight. They've got one potentially, a West Virginia Senator Manchin has said he will help, quote, repair the ACA. But that's going to be tough. I mean, Democrats are holding the line this year, much like we saw Republicans hold the line 7 years ago, 8 years ago, when Democrats were trying to pass their legislation.
No, so and then what happens if the other seven Democrats in the Senate do not come on board?
Well, I think we could see a couple different things play out. And keep in mind that predicting what happens with health reform is a gambler's losing game, given how how many times it lived and died in 2009 and 2010 before it finally passed. But I think one scenario we might see is Republicans essentially deciding, one, we can't get rid of this law. We can't get enough people on board for replacement. So we will make some cosmetic changes around the side and say that we fixed Obamacare. And
really?
We'll take credit. Yeah. I think that's totally in play. And the longer we go this year without any momentum to repeal the law, and there certainly is going to be some time to come up with a replacement, that makes it harder and harder to build the momentum to knock this law down. We're already seeing around the country rallies to save the Affordable Care Act. And you can imagine that if we get to the summertime, when senators, representatives go home and have their town halls, it'll be the flip of what we saw in 2009 and 2010, when Democrats were getting lobbied by their constituents who said, don't pass this health reform. The momentum is now flipping to the, we don't want you to pass this repeal bill because enough of us depend on the Affordable Care Act to protect us against not getting health coverage because of pre-existing conditions and so on. So that's one scenario. I think another scenario is we do end up with some repeal bill and Republicans suffer some political damage from that if they decide that they need to satisfy their base. And I was just reading a poll that Politico did with Harvard. 85% of Trump voters do think that repealing the Affordable Care Act should be the top priority. That is not shared by all voters, but there is a base within the Republican Party, or at least within Donald Trump's support, that wants to see action here.
All right, so we've got comments coming in already. It's early here in the hour, but let's get to them. We've got an email from Carolyn who says, please highlight the fact that repeal involves a huge tax cut, which makes paying for replace a much bigger problem. How do you weigh in on that, Dan?
Well, it's funny that repealing the Affordable Care Act has really overlooked the impact on the deficit, because this was something that Republicans were so concerned about in 2009, 2010. The ACA effectively has helped control growth in deficit spending by reining in some health costs and pushing down Medicare payments, collecting more taxes, and so on. If the ACA is struck down, it's true, there would be a tax cut for some relatively high individuals. That's one way that the ACA is paid for. And then there's this bigger impact, too, on deficit spending. That's something that Democrats are going to be highlighting more and more. It hasn't come up so much yet because they're focused more on just the people who are covered by the Affordable Care Act and the 20 million who could stand to lose coverage if the law goes away.
And we've got an email from Nancy in the Northeast. She says, I found it so beneficial that the ACA allowed me to shop around for an insurance plan that met my needs. My employer knows nothing about my personal health. Why would they get to choose my insurance company? And then she goes on to ask, why do Republicans think that employer offered insurance is better? If you lose your job, you lose your health care. It is a brutal double whammy. And I think you alluded to this a little bit earlier, Dan. If for some reason the ACA is repealed in its entirety and millions end up thrown off of the health care insurance rolls, there might be some a pretty big political price to pay for many in the GOP.
I think what they're worried about, Mary, is the possibility of radicalizing people who weren't radicalized around healthcare before. This law hasn't been popular, partly because folks haven't understood it, partly because some of the effects were delayed. Now there are enough folks who can say, we left our jobs because we know that we could still get health insurance regardless of whether we have a pre-existing condition or not, or people who have benefited from Medicaid expansion. I believe in Pennsylvania there are about 500,000 people who can trace their coverage back to the Affordable Care Act. In Delaware, it's another 40,000 or so. That's a lot of people, and those are people who are going to be especially motivated to punish politicians at the polls if they feel like those politicians did them wrong.
So, Dan Diamond, as all this is going on in Congress and with the Trump transition team, if I am a person who's received coverage through the ACA, what do I do? Sit tight? Just wait to see what happens? What can I reasonably expect?
So I want to be careful not to cross the line from reporting to advocacy, but I think it's fair to say that there are lots of different efforts right now to either put pressure on Congress or, at minimum, to highlight the benefits of the ACA. Bernie Sanders helped coordinate nationwide rallies this weekend, Save Healthcare. There have been some bus tours and other events starting around the country that are supposed to put a human face on the benefits of ACA coverage. Those are fairly easy efforts to find online. You can just look for the Save Healthcare hashtag on Twitter, for instance. Yeah. But I think there is an activist movement emerging around this issue that we really didn't see these past couple years. And I think it's because, Mary, folks are just scared that something that they had started to take for granted isn't going to be there anymore.
Well, and on the flip side, House Speaker Paul Ryan has said, in regard to the Affordable Care Act, this experiment has failed. Failed's a big word. In your opinion, has it failed? And, again, part two of that is there are some serious flaws with the ACA.
So in my opinion, as a reporter, I don't think this law has failed. You have Jim Capretta from AEI, brilliant conservative analyst, coming up. I've talked to him before. He may have a different opinion. But Paul Ryan's argument is that the Affordable Care Act is in, quote, a death spiral, that too many customers are facing too high premiums, that insurance companies are dropping out. And we have seen a little of that in some markets around the country. But I think some of the premium hikes that Donald Trump and other Republicans were really hammering on the campaign trail last year, they overlooked the reality that even though premiums were going up, the subsidies of people who were shopping on the exchanges, so the payments they were getting to defray the premium costs, were going up in lockstep. So even if the average premium was going up 25%, which is huge, that sounds like a big, big number, the subsidies were also going up 25%. So yeah, the impact on most Americans is relatively small. So I don't think the ACA is in a death spiral. I do think it has problems. Democrats will readily admit that. And if politics had been a little more bipartisan the past number of years, Democrats and Republicans could have patched some of those problems together. Now it goes to the Republicans, who could either strike down the law or, again, with their power in the White House, controlling both houses of Congress, do some of those changes that have been delayed for a few years and then call it a win.
All right, Dan, we've only got about 20 seconds left, but two of the ACA's more popular provisions regarding pre-existing conditions, people can't be denied coverage, also the ability of young adults to stay on their parents' plans until the age of 26. What is the latest we're hearing in terms of how whether those provisions might survive?
Republicans say they're going to protect them. The challenge with protecting them is you need to keep some of the less popular provisions to defray them. So we'll see what happens.
All right, Dan Diamond, author of Politico Pulse, a morning briefing on healthcare politics and policy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thrilled to be with you.
All right, and up next, we'll hear from James Capretta of the American Enterprise Institute about how the Democrats and Republicans might find some common ground on the ACA. Stay with us for more of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Democrats and Republicans have been at loggerheads since the concept of the ACA was introduced years ago. And as the Republican-led Congress attempts to roll back much or all of the Affordable Care Act, might there be the potential for some common ground for members of both parties? Jim Capretta is with us for the next 20 minutes or so. He is resident fellow and holds the Milton Friedman Chair at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health care, entitlement, and U.S. budgetary policy, as well as global trends in aging, health, and retirement programs. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. We're glad to be with you.
So President-elect Trump apparently has a replacement plan in the pipeline, and according to the Washington Post, and as we were discussing with Dan Diamond earlier, there was apparently intent to provide insurance for everybody. How do you read this latest news, Jim?
Well, it's obviously a little bit of a confusing situation. He made that announcement in a radio or an interview with the Washington Post reporters that they published over the weekend. And then his spokesperson kind of came out and walked it back some yesterday, I believe. And so, who knows what it means? I mean, I think this is one of these things that's going to take a little while to sort itself out. I do think that there is a growing understanding, and maybe this is President-elect has picked up on this and is trying to sort of run through or thread the needle a little bit in terms of how to make it happen, which is to say that as Republicans think about rolling back the ACA, they have to have a little bit of a goal in mind of what they're trying to achieve with their own replacement plan. What is one of their objectives? What are their many, you know, objectives? And I think he's trying to lay down a marker that one of them ought to be that basically everybody in the United States should be able to get health insurance. And, you know, I don't think that's a particularly controversial point of view. And I think actually the GOP would be wise to sort of take it up despite the difficulty of making it happen and make it really one of their primary goals.
Well, President-elect Trump seems to want Republicans to work with Democrats to, quote, come up with a health care plan that really works, much less expensive and far better, in the words of Mr. Trump. Is there sentiment, Jim, you can see from either side of the aisle, for such a bipartisan effort?
I can't quite see it yet. I mean, there was a letter from some Senate Democrats to the incoming Trump administration, I believe, indicating that they were, or might have been to their colleagues in the Senate, indicating that they were open to discussions about how to make health care better going forward. And so I think there's a little bit of an opening there if Republicans were adept and sort of tried to make that happen. I think one of the things you have to understand is that bipartisanship can kind of happen out of one of two ways. One is because there's a certain feeling of cooperation and, hey, you know, we need to pull together here at this time after an election and do some things for the country. That's one feeling that might motivate some politicians. But the other one is, if you're a Democrat, you might say, hey, look, this thing is, you know, going to happen one way or the other, and we better get in and try to shape this thing, because if we don't, they may pass something that really puts us in a box and makes it difficult for us later politically or substantively, you know, down the road. And so we may as well participate because something's going to happen. And I think, you know, both motivations might push the parties to work together a little bit.
Well, in promoting bipartisanship, you say the Obama administration made a mistake by insisting on parameters the GOP could never agree to, such as, large tax increases on households to pay for much of the added spending, if I'm reading you correctly. Not sure, Jim, if partisan glee is too strong a description for the enthusiasm the GOP is showing in its desire to roll back the ACA, but how do Republicans avoid making this same mistake amid the push to dismantle the Affordable Care Act?
I think it's a difficult temptation. I mean, I think after an election like this, there's always a temptation for those who are newly in the, you know, positions of power to assume that they're going to be there forever, and that they, you know, we won, and you know, we have the mandate, and we can do what we want at this point, and so on and so forth. I think healthcare just doesn't lend itself to that kind of thinking very easily. I mean, frankly, President Obama was in a much better position than even President Trump to do something like that, because he had a massive majority in the House and a 60-vote margin in the Senate that allowed him to move forward with a very Democratic-leaning approach in 2009 and 10. The incoming administration and the current Congress, yes, there's Republican majorities in both chambers, and you have a Republican administration. But the margin in the Senate is very narrow, 52 to 48. And, that means it's going to be more difficult for this administration to move forward with something that was entirely done on with just Republican votes. In fact, it probably is impossible to do because the much of the legislation is likely to need 60 votes anyway. So, you know, how they go about trying to bring some bipartisan cooperation to this is a little bit of a mystery at the moment. I mean, we have an unconventional president-elect about to become president, and so I fully expect the unconventional in terms of legislative strategy and how he communicates to the other party. He's an unconventional politician, and so I think there's going to be a very unpredictable, you know, road ahead in terms of how he might go about this.
Yeah. What should both parties be looking at to ensure public support for efforts to repeal, replace, tweak the ACA?
Well, I think, the big problem with the ACA and the problem that the Republicans are trying to correct, which I think I do agree with, is that the ACA just moved too much power and authority to the central government, to the federal government, to run the insurance system, to require all aspects of what's covered, to really dictate to the states in terms of how they regulate insurance plans, and moreover, to reach into the system of medical delivery through a lot of different mechanisms, through especially the Medicare program, and try to push how the system of provision of care is organized and practiced on the ground level. So it really just was, you know, in a simplistic kind of phrasing, and it's more complicated than this, of course, is that it put too much hope and authority in the federal government to try to run the whole thing. And I think the Republicans are trying to push back on that, to give more space for states, for employers, for individuals, and for practitioners to have their own decision-making processes allowed to occur within a framework that still provides some level of security and comfort to the consuming population that they're going to have accessible insurance as well as accessible health services. Well, so it's going to have to be a balance there. And that's not an easy thing to strike, but I think it's possible.
Well, Jim Capretta, again, you've written that you believe health insurance is a necessity in an advanced economy. And with that in mind, again, let's take a look at some of what Mr. Trump had apparently told the Washington Post over the weekend in an attempt to achieve the goal of health insurance accessible to all. I guess it would be to get insurance for everybody through marketplace solutions, through bringing costs down, through negotiating with pharmaceutical companies, and allowing competition over state lines. Does any of this move that goal forward?
Well, I think there's certainly an element for increased vigorous competition, and that includes both at the insurance level, where there needs to be more and better competition, but also in the provision of services, and that's where the real action is. That is, you know, when people access services, there's a lot of waste, there's a lot of excess cost in the provision of services to patients. And that needs to be, you know, a fundamental point of attack to kind of bring down the cost of the entire superstructure that exists out there so that it's more efficient and more cost-effective when patients use it. And some of that requires a level of competition that allows a patient to access organized systems of care in an easy and accessible way for fixed and transparent prices. And that makes, you know, some of that requires changes in federal policy, frankly. But a lot of it will be made to happen when you put the people that are making the decisions about accessing insurance as well as services in charge of the marginal dollar. Do they spend this more money on this additional level of insurance, or do they spend this money on, you know, a level of accessibility on health services, or are they happy with a lower cost option that actually requires them to use a narrower network? So those are the kinds of things that need to be thought through, and a lot of pressure needs to be brought to bear to bring the prices down.
Yeah, we said earlier in the show, a process with many moving parts. So Jim Capretta, let's get to the phones and get some of these comments in. Maggie is standing by just outside Philadelphia. Welcome, Maggie, to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to make the comment that I feel like there is a lot of sort of philosophical discussion going on about the ACA and whether or not we should have more free market reign in the ACA or whether the government should have more control. And that discussion seems largely to come from folks who either have great health care or do not suffer from pre-existing conditions. I'm an adjunct professor here in Philadelphia. I work at three universities. I have no security and no benefits. I also suffer from multiple sclerosis. My medicine costs $7,000 a month. The ACA is basically keeping me alive and functioning and a productive member of society. For some of us, this leaves the realm of theoretical discussion, and this is the life or death situation. Mm-hmm. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Maggie, so much for calling in. So Jim Capretta, as opposed to looking at things from a philosophical standpoint, are real world stories like Maggie's at the center of discussions in congressional committees, on the floor, in private conferences? What's your take?
Well, I mean, of course, there's this is why this is an important debate and an important subject, because it does have an effect on actual people and their insurance arrangements and their ability to access health care that they need to stay alive and function and perform in society. So, of course, it's important on all those levels. And my point of view has always been that everybody should have health insurance. That in a modern society, I wrote this publicly many times, in a modern society where you have expensive life-saving treatments, of course people need health insurance to be able to afford it when they have the kind of circumstances that this caller has described. So, you know, you get no argument from me that health insurance and the ability to use it when you have an expensive condition is critically important. The question really is the imperative to do that, does that mean that the only solution is to have sort of governmental provision a la a single payer system or of something like Medicare for all in the United States? Is that really the only way to make good on the need to make sure everybody has health insurance? And, you know, I don't believe that that's the only option.
Well, what are the options, do you think, Jim?
Well, I think we're in the middle of discussing many of them. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act isn't even that. I mean, it's a different from a single payer option, as the president would himself admit. And so the question is that the best approach, or is there a different, variation on the same kind of theme, which is to use private insurance, provide some guarantees to make sure that it's accessible and available to everyone, provide protections for people with pre-existing conditions, as they did in the ACA, and as I think they will, in a replacement program, and do it in a way that brings cost discipline so that people aren't spending excessive amounts on things that could cost a lot less with better care and more efficient delivery. I mean, I think that the reality is that we have a great medical system in the United States. We have fantastic institutions, fantastic practitioners.
Yeah.
But it is quite capital intensive and very, very expensive. And that needs to be understood and thought through about how do we do this in a way that is less costly for the average patient.
All right, continuing with our calls, Eleanor joins us now from Newtown. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're live.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am an independent business owner, and I've been paying for my insurance for about 5 years now, and I'm kind of caught in the middle. So I don't qualify for ACA subsidy, and I don't have an employer paying for my insurance. And what I've seen over the last couple of years is rates keep on going up. And I wonder, who's thinking about the people caught in the middle? And, I hear too much about all the subsidies and the employer, paid insurance, and not enough about people like me. So I get the fact that, the Republicans are trying to increase competition and they say the rates are going to go down, but I've seen rates go up consistently over the years, and I've been paying over $1,000 more each year for my insurance.
All right, Eleanor,
so
thanks.
I just wanted to get your thoughts.
Yes, well, and we're going to get them from Jim Capretta. We really appreciate the call to Radio Time. So Jim, people caught in the middle, are they anywhere near front and center in the conversation?
Well, it's hard to tell at the moment, but I think they will be. I mean, what's going on, of course, is that we had an election, and even in polling data going back before the election and subsequent to the election, there's a lot of ambivalence in the country about the ACA and what's going on. I think part of the ambivalence is, yes, it did much to secure and provide large subsidies for people on the lower end of the wage scale, which, of course, is necessary. It also did some things to make it much easier for people with an expensive condition to get into the insurance system without having to pay a differential rate, as the previous caller was discussing. But for people that are not in those categories, they're essentially paying a lot more for what looks to be to them often less attractive insurance, higher deductibles and narrower networks and higher premiums. And so if they're not a heavily subsidized population, then for them it feels like, hey, this isn't working out so well. And I think you see a lot of their sentiment feeding in through the political process. So the question is, can we do something that strikes a balance and allows everyone to feel like they're getting a fair shake at getting affordable insurance in a way that also, frankly, is addressing some of the other important issues that people feel in this country, which is, you know, economic growth and job creation and better, you know, employment prospects for workers. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of moving parts here. I grant that it's going to be a complicated thing going forward, but I do think that the sentiment of the last caller is something that will be addressed.
Yeah. All right. And we've got time to squeeze in one more call before we get to the break. So let's go to Chris in Philadelphia. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Mike, it's a comment. I'm also an adjunct professor like the woman you called earlier. And my question is this, or comment is, while we're discussing alternatives to a single payer system, is it really feasible to retain or maintain a profit motive within the healthcare system while at the same time providing healthcare to people like the lady who called who has MS? To myself, I'm in a similar boat. I have pre-existing conditions, teach at several schools, no benefits, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me that your guests are speaking around or not even speaking to the matter of profit.
Mm-hmm. All right. You know what, Chris? We've got about 30 seconds, so we're going to get to Jim for his response, and we thank you for your call to Radio Times.
Sure. Thank you.
So, Jim, the question of profit, where do we go with this and Chris's question?
Well, look, I think that there's no getting around that in a big, complex economy and health system, you're going to have companies involved in it that are selling products into that system, and they make more money if they sell a good product. Frankly, I think it should be pretty obvious that even in single-payer systems, the national governments are buying products and services from for-profit companies, just like private hospitals do here in the United States. So,
Jim, we're going to have to
question.
Unfortunately, I got to stop you there, but we really appreciate your participation here in Radio Times. Jim Capretta, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Stay with us. Radio Times continues. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We've been talking about the Affordable Care Act and Republican-led efforts in Congress to repeal it. How do Americans feel about all this? We turn to Molly Brody, Executive Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She's responsible for all aspects of the foundation's public opinion survey efforts, including the monthly Kaiser Health Tracking Poll and the foundation's work on Americans' attitudes toward global health policy. Hello, Molly.
Hi.
So, according to the latest Kaiser Health Tracking Poll, what are Americans saying about the Affordable Care Act and efforts to repeal and replace?
You know, it's funny. We've been tracking Americans' attitudes on this really since before the law passed in 2010. So, you know, we're talking 7 years, every month, you know, 84 months, probably talked to more than 100,000 Americans. And what's always been true in every one of those polls is that America's divided on their views of the ACA. About half have unfavorable opinions, about half have favorable opinions. And what's always what's always been clear about those opinions is it's your partisanship. So if you're a Democrat or you're an independent-leaning Democrat, you have a favorable view about the law. And if you are a Republican or a Republican-leading independent, you have an unfavorable view about the law. And that those opinions got set in stone sort of day one, and they never really changed. We, you know, in December when we last asked the question, we got sort of the same answer we've had the 84 times we asked it prior, 46 unfavorable, 43 favorable. And that then carries through to people's views about repeal. So we see very similar perspectives when it comes to repeal. The difference there that many people who are happy to see the law repealed don't want it repealed without knowing what it's going to be replaced with.
So now this is from both sides? This is from both people who are Republican and Democrat leading?
Yeah, well, of course, what happens once you look at repeals, again, you have about half the country saying, don't repeal this at all. We want to keep the law. The other half says, well, okay, repeal, but repeal once you tell me what you're going to do with it. Tell me what you're going to replace it with. And then another part of that group says, no, just go ahead and repeal it. So you end up with about 2 in 10 Americans saying go ahead and repeal it outright, and another about 28% of Americans say I'm okay with you repealing it, but don't repeal it until you tell me what you're going to replace it with.
So, Molly Brody, how about whether repeal would affect respondents directly? You know, perhaps they have an opinion on whether the law should be in place or not, but did the survey talk to them about how this might affect them?
Yeah, you know what's interesting about the law is that, for the most part, Americans have never really understood how the pieces of it do impact them. So what we see, which is interesting, is that when we ask them about repeal, most people don't think it will impact them in any way. So the majority say it's not going to help or hurt my healthcare costs, it's not going to help or hurt my access, it's not going to help or hurt my quality. There's about 20% on either side who think things will get worse for themselves, about 20% who think things will get better for themselves. I think where a lot of that stems is not understanding some of the provisions of the law and how it does impact people's health care coverage. So things like having no cost sharing for preventative health services, that's something that many people are getting a benefit from now, but they don't realize it. And so they may come to be surprised if that sort of provision gets repealed. Another point I should make is that even from the very beginning, with these divided attitudes on the law, there's a lot of individual parts of the law that are actually quite popular with people from a variety of partisan backgrounds.
Yeah.
So, in fact, when we ask people about the provisions themselves, like keeping kids on your health insurance, adults, the children who are, you know, up to 26,
yeah.
Right? People really like that. They like the fact that, you know, that insurance companies can't exclude people with pre-existing conditions. They like the fact that the Medicare donut hole got closed. They like, you know, that it provides financial help to low and moderate income Americans. They like that it expands, that gives states the options to expand Medicaid. So, you know, many, many, many provisions of the law are actually quite popular with people of whether they identify as Democrats, Republicans, or independents. The two features of the law that have never been popular with anybody are the individual mandate that says you have to have insurance and the employer mandate that says larger employers have to provide insurance.
So across the board, you are finding thumbs down from Democrats, independents, Republicans alike on those pieces of the law.
Well, even, you know, for independents and Republicans, they really don't like the individual mandate. Democrats are more have more flexible views on that. But yeah, it's not their favorite part of the law.
So, Molly, let's get back to we've been talking on and off about pre-existing conditions through the show. And I know the Kaiser Health Tracking Poll did ask folks about how people affected by pre-existing conditions would fare if the ACA were rolled back. If I'm reading the information I was saying correctly, you know, full one-fifth of those affected by pre-existing conditions said their access, quality, and cost of health care would get better if the ACA is repealed. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, some people actually do think that. On the other hand, about a third of people with pre-existing conditions in their household think that the costs will get worse. A quarter think that their ability to keep insurance will get worse. And one in five think their quality will get worse. And again, I think some of this goes back to not really understanding how the law works.
Yeah.
And also, to be, you know, frank, not really sure what a replacement plan might provide. You know, I think it's perfectly reasonable, but that since it's not clear what would replace the ACA right now, some people may think that actually could get better under a replacement plan.
So, Molly, I know in the 7 years that the Kaiser Health Tracking Poll has been keeping an eye on the ACA, you found pretty steady sentiment. But at the same time, I was reading through a Kaiser News release, which said that sometimes debate can influence the public's views. So as we're moving through the month of January, and this is more in the headlines and people are probably talking about it more, do you think you'll see some fluidity here in how Americans feel about this particular piece of legislation?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Over time, it has been a pretty steady state, but at times of intense public debate is when we do see some short-term movement on the law. So it's certainly possible that as debate heats up on Capitol Hill and as the news media pays more and more attention to that and the public hears more about it, we could see some views shift. We did a little bit of testing of this back in December, particularly on the idea of repealing. And when we gave people sort of messages that they might hear from opponents or proponents, we did see some movement in their response. So, for example, if people who originally thought that they originally thought that they wanted Congress to repeal the law. If we told them that the proponents of the law would say that some people with pre-existing health conditions would no longer be able to get health insurance, a lot of those people all of a sudden switched and said, oh no, don't repeal now. And similarly, if we told them that about 20 million people might lose coverage, many people switched their views as well. Similarly, if we told people on the other side, the people who didn't want repeal, if we told them about some of the arguments about whether costs have gone up for either the country or for them personally, they would switch their view the other way. So the bottom line is that, yes, it's hard to know exactly how a political debate will play out in the public's mind as they hear different messages. The one thing I will say is that from the very beginning, the thing that Americans have always wanted from policymakers is they want to pay less for their health care. You know, way back at the beginning of the ACA debates, the number one priority for people, and quite frankly, in December when we asked them again, what was the number one health priority for you for the new president and Congress to address, it's lowering people's own health care costs.
It's not the fate of the ACA. It's more about how much health care is going to cost me.
It is. It's how much is going to cost me, how much are drugs going to cost me. That's what people are most concerned about, and that's what they're going to listen for in the context of the debates. And so, you're right. We won't know exactly where public opinion will end up in the context of a prominent debate on Capitol Hill until it happens. There's certainly some chance for some malleability and flexibility in attitudes as people hear things that they like or don't like, or they hear things that scare them about what the replacement plans might mean or what taking away the ACA as it is might mean for them and their family.
So Molly Brody is, lowering the amount we pay for health care. Okay, so that's apparently a main concern. This was a campaign promise made by Donald Trump. What are you hearing from respondents when asked if they're confident that Mr. Trump will be able to make good on this promise?
You know, it's pretty predictable. So people who voted for the president-elect think he will make good on his promise, and people who didn't don't think he'll make good on his promise. So, this is a very divided country right now. It's a very divisive election, and those opinions will continue as, we move forward.
What are some of the top issues Americans want to see President-elect Trump and Congress take on this year? And assuming health care is among them?
You know, health care is sort of a mid-level issue among the things that people care about. There's things related to the economy, to some of the other things that we talked about that were talked about in the election. So economy and jobs is sort of the top issue overall and top for Democrats and independents. Immigration is a top issue for Republicans. Immigration sort of number two for everyone else. Healthcare comes in at three, around three on our list. It's a higher issue for Democrats and independents than it is for Republicans.
Okay. And taking a look at what Kaiser found to be other stories that Americans are tracking this month, we've got President-elect Trump and his cabinet picks. And what else?
That people are paying attention to?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They've been paying attention to the repeal efforts. They certainly were paying attention to the reports of Russia's involvement or not involvement in our presidential election, certainly still paying a lot of attention to the conflict in Iraq and in other parts of the country.
Okay. Let's get to poll methodology. And Molly, what I'm going to do is we've got a whole bunch of comments that have come in to Radio Times. So I'm going to read some of them. And then I'd like you to tell us, if you could, about the process in which poll questions are crafted, what's taken into consideration. So let's get to some of these. And we've got an email from Warren who says, how much did the Republicans blocking some items of the ACA cause problems or some of the issues we see now? Comment from Avi, the ACA doesn't address the people that make too much to get help, but not enough to be able to afford the ever-rising premiums. Tweet from Logo, wondering why Obama and Democrats were prevented from negotiating drug prices because Republican Congress passed a ban on negotiating Medicare drug prices. And let's see, a couple more. Tweet from Christina, who asks, why is there little discussion regarding the insurance industry role in creating astronomical costs and obscene profits? And then one more from Rivka, an email, who says, aren't the current ACA policies in effect contracts for 2017? So it runs the gamut here.
Your listeners are very informed.
Yes.
I'll tell you that much.
Yes,
I have
they are.
To say, they clearly care a lot about health policy and about what's going on, and they know a lot more than sort of the average person does about some of the details happening in health policy. Let me take your broader question about how we craft our questions.
Yeah.
You know, our goal is to give voice to the American public in these debates, and it's to try to help policymakers in the media and other people understand what the public thinks, what they know, and what their experiences are with these sort of healthcare policies. You know, we struggle with trying to make sure that we're providing information that can be relevant for policymakers at the time they're making decisions, at the same time as asking questions that people, you know, who are in their home and are kind enough with their time to give us time on the phone can answer in a reasonable amount of time and with, you know, a basic level of understanding. As you know, and certainly your listeners know because of the nature of those questions, health policy can be pretty complicated. The ins and outs of how you construct an insurance reform plan that can, you know, manage risk and you know, deal with the coverage issues and with people's, you know, changing economic status and, you know, with workplace issues. I mean, it takes a good level of understanding to get into the weeds of a real policy debate, particularly one that's as complicated as our healthcare system and as our health insurance system is. And so we struggle when we ask people questions, and we try to make sure that we're asking them things that they have thought about that they can appropriately answer, and that we can feed back their voice into the political debates.
Yeah, that's interesting. And again, the Kaiser Health Tracking Poll does this monthly, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so but do you see a need perhaps to increase the number of surveys? You know, considering the significance of this one issue, the ACA, and how quickly the landscape is changing. I mean, for instance, just this weekend, word of Mr. Trump's intended plan. You know, so do you think you need to go at it some more or more frequently?
Good question. It's actually the topic of one of my future meetings today. So, you know, it is. It's, you know, we want to keep the voices of the public in center stage in these debates. We want to make sure that their reactions and their understanding and their concerns are part of the political discussion. And that's our, you know, mission with the polling work that we do. So we'll have to consider that as things start to move as fast as they seem to be moving so far this early in 2017.
So this is an important part of the political landscape and the discussion, the polling process, and something that you believe that we should all be looking out for.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know a better way for all the, you know, challenges that there are in making sure you conduct a good, high-quality survey. There isn't any better way of getting representative views of the public inserted into a public debate, especially one that's moving as fast as the ones that we're having. So I do think it's something important for us to continue to do and for others to continue to do. And I would hope that Americans would appreciate that there are folks who are trying to make sure that their voice is part of the policymaking process.
All right. Well, Molly Brody, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you along.
Molly, thank you for having me.
Molly Brody is Executive Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation and is responsible for all aspects of the foundation's public opinion survey efforts, including the monthly Kaiser Health Tracking Poll. And this reminder, don't forget to visit our Facebook page and give a listen to our podcasts. You'll find it all at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and as always, thanks for tuning in to Radio Times.